Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a World War II veteran who saw firsthand the devastation at Hiroshima and also endured more than 500 nights sleeping in foxholes. He even survived a bullet to the helmet.
And goes through and then clunk, out down the back.
There's more to that story, and you'll hear it today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9. It's Hometown Heroes, brought to you here on KMJ by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday on KMJ. Whether you listen to us on the AM 580 at 1 o'clock, on the FM side 105.9 every Saturday at 5, or online at kmjnow.com, you know what Hometown Heroes is all about. It's about the idea that no matter where you live in this country of ours, that there are heroes around you. No matter how big or small your hometown may be, there are people next door, down the street, around the corner, who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And we get to meet them every week on this show. We talk to World War II veterans about their experiences, hoping to preserve those experiences for posterity, honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, and be inspired along the way. That's the idea today as I visit with 90-year-old Les Collins of Hanford, California. He's been in Hanford for 60 years now with his wife, Alice. But let's go back before you even knew Alice existed, Les. December 7th, 1941 is a date that I ask every veteran about because everybody seems to have a pretty clear memory of that day and how he found out about Pearl Harbor. Where were you and how did you get that news?
I was in Detroit. I had been working for a men's clothing and furniture store there. And, of course, this was a Sunday, December 7th, 1941. They had started the draft about a few months before that. People at 18, 19 years old had to register for the draft. And I had gone down, and I had a hand that had given me trouble that I had hurt when I was real small. And they said, forget it, go home. We're not going to do anything for you. Guess what? On December 8th, guess who I had a call from? Selective Service Board. Get yourself in here. And a few months later, I was in Fort Custer, Michigan. And then they needed troops so badly to go to Australia in the South Pacific because most of the troops were in Europe in those days are headed that way. And so I came out from there to Camp Roberts, California for basic training, which was in those days supposed to be 13 weeks. But as I say, they needed troops so badly that they said, we're going to cut it down to about 8 weeks, which they did. And then went to Australia from there. So I joined the 41st Infantry Division, which is home base. It's a National Guard outfit from basically the northwest part of this country and was in service in World War I. We had a number of Indians. All of our non-coms were Indians. Almost all our sergeants were Indians. We had Sergeant Joe Reddor. He was a Sioux Indian chief, and he eventually became the second most decorated soldier in the South Pacific in the Army. They finally made him come home after 3 or 4 years. But anyway, we had all these Indians, and they were, of course, they were approaching. They weren't young anymore because they were World War I veterans, you know, at the end of 1918. And so here we go overseas to Australia, and some of those guys were 40 years old or close to it. You know, they had families, and, of course, there was a very shortage of troops. As a matter of fact, a little highlight, Camp Roberts, California, we had the large parade ground, and they said every person in the military at that time could have stood on the parade ground at Camp Roberts, California.
That's how small our military was at the outset of the war, but it was growing.
15 million World War II, about 2.5 million World War II, what we referred to as combat veterans, the rest are all back up. But so that's where we went to the 41st Division, then to from San Francisco, Sydney, Australia.
What was the moment that you remember where you first felt, wow, this is really dangerous, and I don't know if I'm going to make it back to the United States?
I guess probably the first landings we made, which is above Port Moresby, San Ananda, New Guinea, which is a Buna, it's called. We had gone to another staging area there where all the troops came in, and then our outfit was helping, and they said, okay, guys, this is it. You're going to make your first beach landings, and we had the first one then at Buna. And dangerous place, very, very dangerous place. And that, as you said, that's where you think, you know, either are, you know, but we made 11 beach landings total up and down the coast of New Guinea and the Philippines. So lost a lot of guys. We lost 8,000 troops all the time I was overseas and our outfit completely in total, you know. So
describe for me what that felt like. What are you seeing? What's happening? Are you getting shot at? Are you about to do the shooting? Paint a picture for me.
I carried a gun as anybody else. Japanese did not respect Geneva Convention. Red Cross would have been a target for them. So we carried our medical pouches. At that time, of course, I was just an infantry sergeant, and then carried M1 rifles, which was the rifle. We were the very first former full infantry division that had the M1 rifles. what they call the Grand M1 rifles. And that was, you know, yeah, we made our beach landings off little barges, which I'm certain you see pictures all the time. And, on, and of course, the beaches were narrow. I mean, the jungle's there, like from here across the street, you know, not miles away, just there, right out there. So all of our campaigns basically were on the beach, you know, with trying to take over towns or bases or whatever, just to advance up the coast and get close to the Philippines, to MacArthur's goal, of course, go back to the Philippines. And he said, you guys will take as much territory and get as close to the Philippines as you can, as fast as you can. Because he was having other troops doing the island hop, you know, the Guadalcanals, the Iwo Jimas, and all those, the Kwajalein's and all those islands. You know. The southern part of New Guinea is British New Guinea, controlled by the Australians, where all the natives were and all the fuzzy was and all the natives. Any English-speaking people there were missionaries, either Australian or Dutch. And then north, the half of New Guinea is Dutch. We had some good experience in New Guinea, good experience in Australia, but I might tell you one little story about when we were in New Guinea. These Australian soldiers came along and in our camp area, and they had a Jeep with a little camp trailer behind it, covered with a tarp. And they came to a couple of us, the medics, and said, how did you guys like to go with us up in the inland of New Guinea? We said, we didn't know you could get the inland of New Guinea except by plane, you know. Well, they had a road that they went, because they said, well, there's a village we take care of, but it's about 100 miles inland. And said, there's a special celebration going on this weekend, and you guys are welcome to go with us. So we loaded in a Jeep and went with them, you know. And here we end up, beautiful valley, beautiful place, you know. Almost looks like Yosemite. I mean, a beautiful place, you know. And here they had those big thatched huts, roofs where all these natives lived, you know. And they had food spread out. You couldn't believe it. I mean, just pork and all kinds of food, all kinds of vegetables, everything, you know. And they had these three corrals. A little one, and then a fair size, and then a next size, and a great big one. And they said they're having what's called a Sing Sing. It's a celebration they do once a year. And you guys really are going to enjoy it, you know. So we stayed 2 nights and 3 days, I guess. And they started dancing. As soon as it got dark, they lit their torches and started dancing and singing and doing their drums, you know, and stuff. And they had the small corral was for the kids and the women and then the men. And then they did this for two straight nights. And the third night, they all got together. And in the meantime, during the day, they had a fancy hat contest. It's all the people who build a hat out of whatever they could. Of course, they have orchids and flowers by the millions, and they just had things you never heard of in this part of the country, you know. And bird of paradise, which is illegal for anybody to use except them, you know. It was an endangered species even then, but nobody could touch it except the natives. They had the contest to build the hats, and I always remember this guy. And he built a hat out of palm fronds and sticks, and he put Life magazine covers around the edge. And that was his outside and Bird of Paradise at top. And he was the winner. And so on the final night, they had the dance contest with the kids, the women, and the men, and they put them all together at the last. And then they decided, well, it's time to give away the prizes for this hat contest. And they went back, and these guys said, watch this. And they undid this trailer and took the tarp off, and it was loaded with bolts of material, red, green, orange. And he went up to take his pick, and I think it was a real bright orange or something he picked. And, of course, there he is, draping all around him and dancing and singing. How great it was. That was his prize for the top prize. And then they gave other prizes they'd brought along for the dance contest for the kids or the women and so forth. But it was quite an experience to go up there with those guys and see how the natives really lived. Because these were fuzzy wuzzies, you know. They had the big hairdos, and they chewed betel nut, which made them a little bit off around the edges, you know. And they dyed their hair with it, so they had real white streaks in their hair. When we first went to New Guinea, we could try to bribe the natives. And first time, all we had to do was give them a candy bar or something. We were gone 6 months and came back. Now they wanted money. They wanted other things. They'd learned, you know. And all their money was metal. They had no paper money at all. It was all Australian money. And they wore the chain around the neck. It had a hole in it. So the wealthier people had chains down here with money on. They were not dangerous at all, because these Aussie soldiers are all the time. But they would enlist these natives into the army, and they'd give them just maybe a gun belt or something to start with. But then you saw one in a uniform. He was it, you know, because he had hat, uniform, boots. He had the whole thing, the gun. He had everything, you know. And they were, of course, so naive. One little story one time, this one of the guys was shaving, and he had a little mirror. And this native happened to come up behind him and scared him to death. He saw his face in that mirror. He just jumped back, and then he turned around, and he wanted to look at the back of it. He wanted to turn around and see, where'd he go? You know, he disappeared, you know.
He'd never seen a mirror before in his life.
Never seen a mirror before in his life. And so, they all had to gather around, you know, and you've probably heard stories someplace. There was a New Guinea Navy group one time that wanted to build an airplane to fly off a hill, you know. They built it out of palm fronds and sticks, and they were going, because they saw the American planes fly over, so they wanted to build this airplane to fly away, you know, so. But they are very, very naive, you know. But But they learned, I'm certain today they probably as many diseases as we have, you know, because we had malaria so much, you know, so I had it 30 some times while I was overseas.
I know that you certainly had motivation to fight for your country, and your country had been attacked by the Japanese, and here it is, the Japanese that you're fighting against. But when you experienced the natives in New Guinea and saw their way of life, did you feel at all that you were trying to preserve that for them as well, for their right to be who they were?
Sure. Oh, yeah, that was. And the Australian soldier said, you know, that's one of the reasons you guys, one of the reasons we thank you guys for being here, because you will help with the landings and getting Japanese troops. You will preserve the life of these natives here there in this area, you know. And that was true all the way through, all the way up to Dutch New Guinea and all the way into the Polynesian Islands and all up to Bayak, you know, which is above New Guinea. That's where MacArthur established its headquarters after planning to go to back to the Philippines, and it was on Bayak.
You said that initially you were an infantryman, and then you volunteered to be a medic. How did that come about, and what was the motivation there? Because I've been told you're never supposed to volunteer for anything in the Army.
That's so true, but they came around saying we desperately need medics so badly, and of course I said I had worked for Walgreens for about a year and a half or so, and we had mixed medicines, you know, external things, you know. I said, sure, why not? We'll give it a try. Of course, there was no training for it. You just start, it was on-the-job training. You started giving shots, the guys loaned up, you know, lined up, and you gave them shots, you know. And every time in New Guinea, every time you stopped anywhere for any rest at all, there was always some type you had to give shots, because you never know what was in the air and in the water and in the, everything else, you know. So we took quinine first for malaria, because that's all they really knew in this country. But that was a different type of malaria, too, that they had never encountered. It was even different than they have in Africa. And so we took the quinine. It got to your ears got so bad you couldn't hear a thing. The biggest gun we had could fire and knock you off your feet, and you couldn't hear it. So our regimental command, our doctors came around and said, hey, guys, no more quinine. They're developing something else, but we're just going to suffer in that. It was probably a year before they came with Adderin, which was the next drug for malaria. So everybody, we had a one-time stretch from weeks and weeks where, if her fever wasn't 104, you stayed on duty, you know. I mean, that was, God come to me and say, hey, Doc, I have fever, 104. I'd say, join a crowd, so do I. What makes you so special?
I'm guessing that most people listening have never had a single bout with malaria, much less three dozen like you did. So tell us, what does that do to you? What does it feel like, and how do you keep on going when you experience it?
You have to keep on going, because nobody take your place. We had 3,000 or 4,000 troops in our regiment right there, you know, and where are you going? Nobody take your place. You're 1,000 miles from anybody, anywhere, and the jungles there, and New Guinea coast there, and islands out there. Where are you going? So your malaria basically attacks your, you have chills and fever. Chills would come up. Alice remembers when we were first married, and I'd already been out of service 4 years, but I'd get up in the morning, weak as can be. And then you have the chills all day, and then you have the fever all day, and then you develop the chills, and then next day it's kind of off a little bit, and then the third day it starts all over again. You do that for a week and over again. I mean, that's why they say it all these times. Only one time we went to the hospital for it. I was so sick, they said, you're going to field hospital. One of the Mayo brothers, Charlie Mayo, formed the field hospital in New Guinea, nephew of the original Mayo brothers of Rochester, Minnesota, and he set up a field hospital. He was a colonel in the Army, and so I went down for like 2 or 3 days. They put me back to work as soon as I was able to get up and around again, went back to my outfit. And most of the guys did not go to the hospital for malaria, because everybody had it. What are you going to do? You know, you can't get over it. What are you going to do with it? You're there, so you're going to stay where you are, you know.
So would you say it was just willpower that helped you keep going in spite of that?
What are you going to do? Where are you going? You had to be there, and that was your job, to stay and do whatever you had to do, you know. And guys weren't running off, I'm sick, I'm this, I'm that, I'm crazy, I'm this. They were just, we were there defending the beaches and doing what we had to do, you know, and that was it, you know.
I imagine made you lose a little bit of weight.
Only lost 50 pounds while I was overseas.
Only 50 pounds?
Only 50 pounds.
You had more than 30 bouts with malaria, and you said only one of them was bad enough to put you in the hospital.
Just one time I went to the hospital, because just could not get over the shakes. It just went on and on, you know. They just could not get past it, you know, because normally I say you got the fever, and then, you know, it lasts, and the shakes come on for 3 or 4 hours, and then you're gone, and the next day you're just weak. But about 2 days worth. I just didn't, just shaking so much. And the regimental doctor came in and said, hey, Doc, you're off to the hospital. I said, no, I'm not. And he said, yes, you are. So I did, you know. So, and then, of course, they were so short of medics in the evening field hospital. So they said, you go over there and work in that ward while you recuperate, another, stay another day with us. So, but I was in charge of that ward then. It was over there.
So the patient was running the hospital.
The patient was running that ward, you know. Yeah.
And it, you know, it strikes me, now, I would have been scared out of my mind just being in combat there the way you were. But then when you're a medic and you're supposed to be taking care of other guys and you can't even stay on your feet because you're so ill. It seems like that's got to be a really scary situation, scared because of your health and scared that also you might not be able to do your job right, and that might get you killed.
That's so, too. Unfortunately, of course, in our outfit with our 3,000 or more troops in our immediate unit, we had about 22 to 25 medics total altogether, you know. So, matter of fact, when a couple landings we made, we had 33 medics in it, you know. So there were guys around, you know, to take over. But, you see, we had such primitive things. We had three sulfa drugs, and that's all. We had morphine and three sulfa drugs, and that was it. Nothing else. No penicillin. Penicillin wasn't actually used in service until about March of 1945 when we were in the Philippines, well, close to the end of the war. It had been developed, like Dr. Fleming developed discovered it back in 1928 in England, but it wasn't commercially used until the mid-40s in the hospitals here and then overseas. But so I think it was about March of 1945 we were in the Philippines that we finally had penicillin. So we used bayonets and promphons and stuff to for splints and those kind of things, you know, whatever you could use, you know. You did what you had to use. It was primitive stuff.
You had to improvise quite a bit.
All the time. We didn't have anything. Got to the point all you had to carry was morphine syringe, you know, and somebody got wounded. Why, that was the first thing was jab with a morphine syringe, you know, and that was the first thing you did. And we got to the point where we started running out of sulfa drugs, sulfanilamide, sulfathiazole, and we had sulfaguanidine, which was really for diarrhea. But we had a couple of guys that got shot and had big holes in their leg, one on an arm and one leg, and we just mashed it up and put it in the wound. It's a sulfa drug, so it's going to do the job, right? Wrap it up, you know. So you run around out of things to do. You do whatever you have to do.
Absolutely. And, well, I know one thing they had to do for you is something we haven't touched on yet, so we'll do that when we come back. 90-year-old Les Collins of Hanford is our guest today, an infantryman and then a medic with the 41st Infantry Division in the South Pacific. Still to come, the story of how he earned the Bronze Star and how long he had to wait to receive it. And before we hit the break, I know you're pretty observant, so you probably noticed at the beginning of this show that Hometown Heroes is now brought to you by Humana. I want to officially welcome Humana as a sponsor of this show and a supporter of our mission to honor our veterans. If you're not familiar with Humana, it is a healthcare company. The website is humana.com if you want to learn more. And you won't hear me say this often because I never want to distract from the purpose of this program. But if you would like to support Hometown Heroes by advertising your business specifically within this show, you can call me here at KMJ or email me at paul@kmjnow.com. More from Hanford's Les Collins when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
That bed, I heard my wife say in a way that I knew she was either really, really happy or really upset. Paul Leffler here for Sleep Retreat, and if it had been the latter, I wouldn't be telling you about it. No, she was excited. That bed, she said, is so comfortable. She had just gotten her first taste of our new Tempur-Pedic mattress from Sleep Retreat, Fresno's only premium bedding store. And I'm not making this up, she didn't want to move. That's how much she loves the comfort and support that Tempur-Pedic's technology delivers. This is not one mattress fits all. The trained professionals at Sleep Retreat can walk you through the whole spectrum from soft to firm. But the one thing all the Tempur-Pedics have in common is they adapt to your exact shape to support every part of your body. If you've slept on a conventional mattress your whole life, like I have, this is something you've never experienced before. Do yourself and your sleeping habits a favor by trying out the most recommended bed in America. Visit your Tempur-Pedic Comfort Center in Central California. That's Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We have heard from 90-year-old Les Collins about his service with the 41st Infantry Division in the South Pacific, about those dozens of bouts with malaria and the primitive medical supplies he had access to once he volunteered to become a combat medic. Les, the medic, only had to become the patient once for malaria, he told us. But Les, you didn't say anything about having to have your appendix taken out in the middle of a war zone.
Had emergency appendectomy, and once again, that's when the doctor said, you're going to the hospital, you're having an appendicitis attack. I said, no, I'm not. He said, yes, you are. So that's where we went. Went to the field hospital. Dr. Mayo was gone, and somebody else is running the hospital, and this is up way up in Dutch New Guinea in those days. And so that's where I went to the hospital. And at ether, the old fireman, the oldest drug there was, you know, anesthetic. And it made everybody in the place sick, including me. Everybody was in there was sick with the ether, you know, from my ether, you know. And I only stayed in the hospital after the operation for 3 or 4 days. You had to get back your outfit. They need you, you know. So that's where I was.
You're having this appendix taken out, and this is not some big sterile hospital. You're actually in a war zone, and you could actually get shot while you're in there.
Yeah, because it was just a big tent with generators with the big lights over a table, over an operating table, and that was it, you know. And of course, the doctor doing the best they could as far as sterile was concerned, but what do you do, you know? All you could do is heat water and have something to sterilize instruments, you know. That's what we did. We gave shots. We gave shots. We'd line up a whole company of guys, like 200 or 300 guys, you know, and have needles laying there and just reach down, and you just walk along and give shots as the guys came down, you know. It was enough a health field hospital they could do. They couldn't do major things, but they could do quite a few things.
When you make as many landings as you did, 11 landings that you talked about, and when you fill the role of a medic for so many of those, I imagine there are a lot of guys that you had to treat, or at least try to treat. Give us a taste of what that was like when the combat is taking place. What are you doing? How are you keeping yourself alive and trying to help others at the same time?
This might be a good place to tell you about my Bronze Star. Off of the coast of New Guinea, there's a town in New Guinea, a village called Tome, T-O-E-M, and about 2 miles off the coast is an island called Wadke Island. I have a book here, and I can show you pictures of it after a while. And it was a couple miles off the coast. It was just big enough for an airstrip, and it was all. And MacArthur said, you will take that island because you need that airstrip. That was the first place small planes could fly and reach the Philippines. They couldn't fly from the other islands, they were too far. And see, the planes, like in Europe, they had the B-17 bombers. They no way, and they used them in the South Pacific. Distance was too great. So we had what they called the B-24s, big four-engine plane. They could fly all over the Pacific, but the P-40s and 41s and P-38s could not fly that distance. So they knew they could from that airstrip. So MacArthur said, you will take it, jungle-covered island. And they bombarded it with, you know, battleships in World War II, the big battles like Missouri and these big battleships, you know, could fire 25 miles. 16-inch guns could fire 25 miles, you know. And they bombarded for 24 straight hours. And then our artillery was down the coast from us away, and they bombarded for 24 hours. 5 o'clock in the morning, we get on landing barges, about 3,000 of us on landing barges to go across there. And you go, like, probably from here across the street, kind of smooth, you know, out in the ocean there, landing barges. But then got to the beach, and it was like this, up probably maybe 2 or 3 times the height of this house. And that's where the landing strip was up there. A Japanese pillbox sitting right there. And all that happened, they knocked down all the cover. So now they had to set machine guns sticking straight out of those pillboxes, knocking our boats out of the water just right and left. You can't use tanks in the South Pacific, of course, those islands where we were. But we had always had an LST, a landing ship, what's called landing ship tank, what's an LST is. And it had one tank in it. So they brought it up, and that's the only way you get up on the top was few guys at the time following, carrying the guns and using flamethrowers or whatever they used to get up onto the airstrip. Took from 5 o'clock morning to 2 in the afternoon to get up there. And I don't know how many guys were lost, a lot of them, but there were 33 of us in the medics. They had told us in intelligence, good old Army and military intelligence wasn't much different than this today. They didn't know anything either. But they said there were probably 300 Japanese troops. There were 3,000 Japanese troops, and there were 3,000 of us. We took 3 days to completely take over the island. And out of our 33 medics, only 2 of us went back. So that's where my Bronze Star came from.
So 33 medics and 2 walked out of there. The other 31 were either killed or wounded.
We probably had 4 or 5 were killed. The rest of them were wounded, you know. So another guy and I were the only ones that went back.
Well, number one, that says you beat some pretty good odds. And number two, that tells me that you probably had some pretty close calls in those 3 days.
I should say so. Yeah, terrible, you know, yeah. All kinds. We had one fellow that had a Browning automatic rifle, and he sat at a cave edge as Japanese troops are coming around the other, coming out of their holes and coming around the other sides of the island, or the other airstrip, and he sat there and firing that running automatic rifle until the barrel melted. The barrel and it melted completely. He was given a Silver Star for his.
Well, and I can tell that you don't want to brag about it, and I understand that, but can you give us an idea of why they felt you deserved a Bronze Star, what you did that the government said that was really courageous?
Taking care of all the guys who were wounded and killed and all, but basically that was basically it. Probably, I have no idea in the world how many people that a bunch of us took care of that time, you know, used all my medical supplies. I used everything I had when time we were there, you know, so I have no idea what, just doing your job, I guess, is all I figure, you know, but they decided that was worth it, you know.
It seems to me like that's got to be exhausting and draining and sometimes hopeless work.
Well, yeah, because you're not talking about, I'll go over there and lay down for 6 hours. You're there. We were there for 3 straight days. Might have napped a little here and there, you know. We still tried to dig foxholes at night as best you could, as close to the beach as we could, but not enough of them by a long ways for all those kind of troops, you know. So what are you going to do? Get behind bunkers, get behind their pillboxes, and have a couple of guys stand with rifles while you try to eat something or nap something and open your K-rations. And, you know, because we lived on K-rations for 17 straight months in New Guinea. So, yeah, but behind some of the Japanese pillboxes or whatever you could, wherever you could. Trees were gone. Cover was all gone, you know. So you didn't get an awful lot of rest, you know.
How hard was it to have a wounded soldier come your way and not be able to do much for him? I imagine that's got to be one of the hardest things.
It probably was the very hardest thing to see somebody got shot stomach or chest or something like this. Leg wounds are a little different, you know, but of course, you're talking about such primitive things. Leg wounds can be pretty dangerous, too, in New Guinea, in the jungles. It's not like here where they give you a tetanus shot and you're okay, you know. That's a little different story, you know. So you had to be awful careful, and yet the most unsanitary kitchens you could find, too, of course, you know. Just nothing. Not even anything to heat something or to heat water or to, you know, I mean, what are you going to do, you know? I remember one fellow that we had was shot, and he had a leg wound. We thought, well, you know, let's take care of somebody else. Let's do what we can, but let's put him aside and take care of someone that's really in bad shape, you know, which he did. He died the next day. You know, I mean, you know, how do you, mental state, you know, maybe he's shocked to death. I mean, it was shocked because maybe we didn't get to him soon enough for the shock treatment for it, you know. I mean, how do you know, you know, so... Of being a medic, that's probably the very worst part there is, right there. Of not being able to do what you need to do and feeling so helpless and in it, you know, not being able to do anything, you know.
The one thing that seems to be a common thread from my experience in talking to guys who worked in the medical corps, whether they were in the Army or the Navy as a corpsman or what have you, a lot of guys seem to share with me stories of courage that they witnessed in treating so many guys who had gone through so much, suffered such extreme injuries, that they saw some really courageous soldiers. Are there some that stick out in your mind?
Not too many, but a couple would say, hey, Doc, you're sicker than I am. Why don't you take care of yourself? I mean, that kind of thing. You know, don't worry about me. Take care of yourself. Or you have shrapnel on your hand. Why don't you bandage that up and take care of it? One of you guys take care of your shrapnel. I say, no, we need to take care of you. You know, that's just a little bit of blood. Don't worry too much about that. We can take care of ourselves, you know. You probably don't see any more courage or any more camaraderie than on the battlefield, any place in the world, any place in the world. I'm certain you ask that of other soldiers from Afghanistan to Korea to World War II, they're probably all going to tell you the same thing.
No doubt, no doubt. But there's something you didn't tell us. You told us your Bronze Star came on Wakdi Island, that 3-day battle in May of 1944 that the military referred to as Operation Straight Line. You even told us that of the 33 medics involved, you were one of only two that survived unscathed. But your helmet did not. Where and how did this happen, that a bullet came in the front of your helmet and never penetrated your skull?
The beach landing, going up on the beach, yeah. And they were firing, and matter of fact, the helmet wasn't mine. It belonged to a lieutenant. But we had, in the dark, we'd put on the wrong helmets. I'd put on his, he'd put on mine. So, but, you know, we had helmet liners. And, you know, you see in the movies, which are 199% wrong, it shows guys going on patrol, passing their helmet straps. You do that, you're going to get killed. If a bullet hits you, you're going to get killed. If a bullet's going through it, it's not going to bounce around between it. So you left the straps, tin straps open, and then there's a liner in it, so the bullet goes into the liner and bounces around and goes out of there. Same.
So you're coming up onto the beach, and you're hoping to find someplace safe so you can help some guys in case they get wounded, and you had to feel something.
I don't know. What do you say? What do you feel? You know, what do you think about it after all these 70 years? You know? I have flashbacks, but it's not really that. My flashbacks have to do with jungle at night or the noises or some of those kind of things, not to... Some actual battle things, but mostly the flashbacks do. And I still have them. I still have them after all these years. You know, so.
And, you know, and I don't want to push and pull and drag that stuff out of you, but I think it is important that people understand that. And you're not alone. So many veterans have carried this with them for 70 years, and that's quite a burden. But on this bullet, you're not even wearing your own helmet. You're wearing the lieutenant's helmet. And it comes in where? Right in the front of the helmet?
Right on the side here. And
right above your right eye.
And goes through and then... clunk, out down the back.
And you felt that.
You feel a little burn, as a matter of fact, down here, sure. But you hear the noise, of course, but you could feel a little burn from it, you know. Yeah.
I'm sure you've told this story before, but it sure seems like you don't think that's a big deal. I think the rest of us think that's a really big deal.
Well, you survive it. That's a big deal. Other people were getting killed. Other people were getting shot in the head and every place else and getting killed and shot in the stomach and everything else. So if you manage that, you know.
Well, and you even... just said a moment ago that if you fasten your chin strap, that helmet's going to hold firm, the bullet's going to have a clean path through it, and it's going to go inside your skull, and you're going to be dead right there. So to me, that's about as close as you can come. If you had just fastened that chin strap, you wouldn't be talking to me right now.
Probably very true. Of course, those helmets were all purpose, you know, bathing things and water things. And some of the places, you know, New Guinea, especially Dutch New Guinea, was almost all coral, you know. And so if they came in and made an airstrip, they just had to bring in CBs and bring in and just grind it down and make, how long do you want it, you know? 1,500 yards, what light airstrip do you want, you know? But then there'd be puddles and it rained at night, and what? So we'd let set our helmets out at night to gain water for them. Can't keep up water a day unless it rained. Of course, there are places in New Guinea like Equator, rained every night. You get in your foxhole and water come up to here. And then in the morning it's like fog here and like steam, you know?
I take it from you sharing that you still have flashbacks about those moments that the nights there had to be pretty scary, not knowing if you were safe where you were sleeping.
Foxholes, side by side. I've always said a foxhole is a grave only narrow, on the shallower, you know. And guys would either share a foxhole or right side by side. And one would head one direction and the other way. And we'd put a rope or string or something with a foot. So we could, any noise at all, you could just jank and wake the other guy up, you know. We were this place, Tome, which is opposite Wadke Island, and we'd string cans across there with bullets in them or rocks in them or something, you know, so, and a chain so it would rattle. So people tried to come through and hit low one and went high and a high one. Of course, Japanese troops are not very big, but down low and high, and you'd hear them rattle and then yells and scream and come firing right across your foxhole, right out to the beach, right out to the ocean, you know. And they just roam around and fire guns there and fire all around the outfit. People stay down. You get up, you're dead. I mean, you move, you're dead. Once in a while, somebody would manage to stand their foxhole and throw a hand grenade toward the ocean or something. I remember this one place at home, and probably a week straight, it would happen to be, you could set your clock. It was midnight when they came zooming through. And 20 minutes, they were gone. Back through the jungles again, you'd hear them. They'd hear the cans rattle. Back, they were gone. Next night, midnight, same thing. Probably not see them in the daytime.
I don't think I would have been sleeping very much.
Most of us didn't. Couldn't take your clothes off. We go months without taking your clothes off, you know. Months, you go down the river and take a bath in your clothes, and guys standing with rifles, you know, while you're... And we didn't have combat boots. Everybody else had combat boots except the infantry. All the supply and everybody else had the combat boots because they got them first, you know. So we had the lace-up boots, and so you take that off your leg. I had jungle sores, knee to ankle, and I still have jungle rot. You still see spots right at jungle rot over those years, you know.
It's hard to imagine how you kept going through that. What do you think it was? Was it thoughts of people at home you had to get back to? Was it willpower? Were you praying a lot? What do you think got you through that?
Combination of home thoughts, combination of what are we going to do after war, combination of how soon do you think this is going to be over, rumors you hear here and there, you know. I need to tell you a little bit one of these times, a little bit about Tokyo Rose. I'm certain somebody's told you about Tokyo Rose.
Of course. And I think you just gave everybody a great reason to stick around through the break. Les will tell us how the infamous propagandist got his attention. We'll also hear about what Les found when he was assigned to Hiroshima in the wake of the atomic bomb. Check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes section of KMJNow.com, or you can find that whole photo gallery by accessing Hometown Heroes on Facebook. And we'll be right back on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K through 12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose. For years, Paso Robles has been known for the Mid-State Fair and its world-class wineries. Coming Saturday, September 29th, a new event will join those two. Estrella Warbird Museum, in conjunction with the Plains of Fame Air Museum, presents Warbirds Over Paso. Thrill to the roar of P-51 Mustangs, a P-38 Lightning, F-4U Corsair, and even a North American B-25 Bomber. Tour the C-47, a true veteran of World War II, and see many more in breathtaking flybys. See the world's only N-9M Flying Wing, forerunner of the B-2 Stealth Bomber. Warbird rides available before and after the flying display. Gates open 8 a.m. Admission $20. Active duty military and kids under 12 free. Admission includes open house at the museum, free parking, food and beverage vendors on site. Sponsored in part by Firestone Walker Brewing Company, it's Warbirds Over Paso, Saturday, September 29th at the Paso Robles Municipal Airport on Airport Road off Highway 46. Call 805-277-0440 or go to ewarbirds.org/airshow.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Time to continue with Les Collins, 90 years old, a recipient of the Bronze Star, not to mention a combat infantry badge and combat medic badge for his service with the 41st Infantry Division in World War II. You can see a photo of those medals online at kmjnow.com, and that's also where you can access the podcast version of this interview. There are some extra portions that would not fit in our allotted time today, so check that out if you want a few more anecdotes from Les. He promised us a story about the infamous propaganda queen, Tokyo Rose. I guess she put a pretty good scare into you.
Our whole outfit. We were in Bayak in the Northeast Indies, and we were down on the beach, as a matter of fact, and there was an airstrip was up above. We hadn't taken it yet. We had all our troops down here. About dusk at night on our radio broadcast, Tokyo Rose would come on and say, "Hi there, guys of the 41st Division. How's Jim doing from St. Louis tonight, you know? What do you suppose your girlfriend Mary's doing tonight? Who do you suppose she's out with?" And then they play the big band music, you know. So this one night, we were still down the beach. We were still trying to get the airstrip up. It was up there, and Japanese planes were coming up there. And what we called Washing Machine Charlie, you could hear them, zoom, 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 zoom. We're down there, and she's broadcasting, and she said, "Have a good night, guys, because when you wake up tomorrow morning, all you'll see will be Japanese ships." So we got settled down, as they say, it got dark suddenly, and got light the next morning the same way. We look out in the morning and just loaded with ships as far as you could see were ships out there. And guy said, this is it. A couple of our guys had binoculars, so it's getting light. One guy looks out and said, "Guys, look at that. That's an American flag." It still bothers me. Anyway.
You just gave me a taste of what it felt that day, because I can see the emotion you have now. You went from complete fear to that American flag was the best thing you ever saw, huh?
American aircraft guy was sitting out there. A little while later, this little destroyer came in, had a hole the size of that couch in the side of it, and they pulled up to a dock. There was a big, long dock area there by a destroyer came up, and these guys came off, and we said, "Where did you guys come from?" He said, "Well, Admiral Spruance was one of the fleet commanders, had intercepted a Japanese code and cut them off. There were a whole bunch of ships." And so they were out there, and there were a couple of carriers, and a couple of, I think even a battleship, and they said, "Well, what we're going to do, guys, we're just going to protect you. The island, Bayak Island, is 50 square miles, and that's where MacArthur set his headquarters. It used to be, there was a big mansion in the center of Bayak that had to belong to some pineapple growers and coconut, you know, plantation owners, and MacArthur come and get, well, he was planning to go to the Philippines, and so our job was to protect that island. We never had that kind of a scare between there and onto the Philippines, you know, but of course we went back to the Philippines and with MacArthur and made landings in the Philippines too, so last place we were in the Philippines was at Zamboanga, which is right opposite Borneo, just down the tip of the southern Philippines in Zamboanga. There was a reservoir that they had there for the water supply for the island, and so that was our job, was to take that reservoir, which we did, you know, and that's where I was when the war ended in August of 45, was in Zamboanga, Philippines. And then we hear atom bomb had been dropped, and we're going home, but of course we didn't go home. Everybody else is going home. They had point system, you know, to in World War II to send troops home. We had like 180 points or something. You only needed 120 or something. He said, well, MacArthur has something special in mind for the 41st Division. We were the oldest division in the South Pacific, made the most beachland, including Marines of any outfit in the South Pacific. And he said, you're going to Hiroshima for occupation troops.
6 weeks after this weapon the world's never seen before absolutely destroyed that city, you're there in Hiroshima.
70,000 people killed that day. There's more in this room than there was there down in that whole town. The city was the size of Oakland, California, but we were stationed at the port of Hiro, which is 4 miles from Hiroshima. Yep. Aircraft workers' barracks, and we took over there, our whole division. We had 28,000 troops, 26,000 or 28,000 troops then, because we were practicing for landings in Japan. Right. We were training for landings in Japan. We would have been the first nine divisions would have gone in, and we were in the very first ones. And they expected the first nine to be 100% casualties, plus there are about another 25 or 30 divisions after that.
As you're there looking firsthand at the incredible devastation that bomb leveled on Hiroshima, I guess you also realized that it probably saved your life.
Of course we did. Yeah, there have been a lot of, you know, billions of controversy words over years after it, should you have done or not, but we wouldn't have been there. Our whole outfit would not have been there, and hundreds of thousands of our troops would never have been there. And when we actually saw the places that only... The only two places I actually saw that we could travel to that looked like they could, where they said they could have landed, there's no way in the world. Japanese had caves there with ammunition, food, guns that came out on tracks, could fire right straight down the top of you. There's no way in the world ever, I don't care who the troops were, could have landed there. No way in the world they could have ever made it to them. Yeah.
And you're speaking from experience, having been involved in 11 landings, that this landing would have been impossible.
Our officer says there's no way in the world. Even all landings we'd made, there's... Experience, no way, ever make it there, you know. Everything would have been shot out of water. Even the ships coming in with the landing barges would never have made it. That, you know, never made it to the landing area, would never have made it, you know, because they were just sitting up there with 155 millimeter guns in caves, you know, on tracks.
And I know that we've talked about malaria and the bouts of malaria you had long after the war was over back here in the States for years after the war. But what about being in Hiroshima? Did you have any effects of lingering radiation?
They told us we didn't have, and they still tell me I don't have. Of course you do, no question about it. Yeah. But they knew nothing about the radiation, see? So they said, yeah. No. I've been fighting VA for 8 years because over it.
Yeah.
And they say, no, you weren't exposed.
Well, common sense would seem to indicate otherwise. And I understand when you got there, it was quite the spectacle.
We went in, all of our troops, 26,000 troops, just like we're going to make a landing. It's a big dock area, great big dock area. And warehouses, all kinds of warehouses, because it was a staging area for a lot of their aircraft things and so forth, you know, and submarines and stuff. We'd land and start marching down between these warehouses, and before we start down between them, our officer said, you know, guys, you're going to have a special thing here that nobody's ever seen before. They had, you know, Japanese policemen wear black uniforms and helmets. They were lined up back to back, shoulder to shoulder, our entire march of 4 miles, and we marched between them. 26,000 troops, and to our camper at MacArthur, put out the word, nobody out, no business, nothing going out, nobody outside, nobody looking out, nobody doing anything. That was a humiliation for the Japanese. It was that, you know, especially for humiliating their police force.
Right.
That was a police force, not the army. That was a police force. So we marched the whole 4 miles, and once in a great while, you'd see a flick of a window someplace or something, you know, but, and they were not allowed to say a word, not allowed to move, not allowed to do a thing, you know, to stand there back to back.
So you saw what the atomic bomb did to these people. What kinds of stuff did you see? What were you treating?
Burns. People burned all over, you know, just face scarred burns, terrible burns, hands, arms, faces. There's a German priest there named Father Kleinsorge, and there were about 20 nuns, and they were missionaries. I think there were three priests altogether. And so he came to us and said, guys, you have medics. Can you help my nuns? Can you help us treat some of our people, you know? And so we did what we could, you know. Then they sent in two big hospital ships, anchored them there, and they put as many as they could, sent them to the Philippines and to Hawaii. And then Commanding General sent out orders, everybody gather, because every other day, half the outfit's going to Hiroshima to work. And they sent in supply ships, sheet metal, and they called for tradesmen, of course, 500 carpenters stepped up, for 500 electricians or whatever, that many troops, you know, and they started building wood and metal buildings, metal roofs and stuff, as many as fast as they could, you know. So half our troops worked over, I don't care whether band members or who they were there working, you know, every other day. One thing I didn't tell you at the very end of the war was we had American POWs in the Philippines, Cabanchuan and Santo Tomas, which are two American Japanese prison camps in Manila. So they asked for all medics from every place, our division and everybody they could, to go there and help with our troops to get them back to health as fast as they can, to get them on the hospital ships, to get them sent home, you know. So we were up there about 10 days or 2 weeks right after the war, you know, waiting to go home, you know. But.
And I imagine that had to be difficult to see the physical state that they were in.
They were like I was. They weighed 100 pounds, 120, 110 pounds, some of not even that, you know. Terrible shape, skinny, you know, terrible shape. But we did the best we could and put them on some of them on hospital ships and sent them to the Philippines and sent them to Hawaii and sent some of them back to Australia, I think.
So when you finally got to come back to America, what did that feel like for you? And how much older did you feel than when you went over?
20 years. We came back. The last troop ships coming from Japan, I left Nagoya, Japan on the 9th of December, 1945. So guess what? We travel past Hawaii, come within the lights of California, and the commander of the ship comes on and says, guys, I hate to tell you this. We're not going to San Francisco. We're going to New York. Those lights you see there is California, but our troops, our crew signed on from New York. If we dropped off in San Francisco, we'd have to re-sign and we'd hire a whole new crew. So we went through the Panama Canal and went to New York City. And they were still greeting those days. That was January 6th of 1946. And they were still greeting troops with the fireboats in New York Harbor. So we came up on those and up on the docks and everybody up there giving sewing kits and shaving kits and coffee and, you know, all kinds of things. They went to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, which is not very far. It was manned completely by German POWs. See, when we first went to Hiroshima, October, we'd gone like this, Philippines, and no uniform, you know, summer clothes, you know. And we go there, and the first or second day of October, it snowed. So it was cold, and everybody started catching pneumonia. Plus, you're going to catch it. We were so beaten down with malaria. Everybody was so sick anyway, you know. And they had just started developing flu influenza from chick embryos. And so we were the first outfit to use it, but everybody had the flu, pneumonia and everything else. So we were not only treating malaria and everything else and treating Japanese troops and our troops, we were treating from flu too. Then they just brought in flu in uniforms, whatever they were, wool uniforms. Go over there, guys, and get what you can wear. I mean, just pile them over there and get what you can wear. So we got to Camp Newark, Jersey. We looked like recruits. We looked like somebody never been in service at all, you know. Matter of fact, I remember we were going down to PX and these guys sitting there in their starched uniforms. They were probably MPs, you know. Look at these rookies coming in. And one of the guys said, take a look at them and see what kind of rookies you think they are. What do they look like? Well, they don't look too good. They spent the last 3.5 years in the South Pacific. Where have you been, you know? And so they put out word, said, and we had barracks, of course, and to sleep in. And they said, you can go to bed, you can go whenever you want, and you can leave for camp, you can go to New York City if you want, you can go anywhere you want, you're not going to be needed for at least 24 hours. But you cannot leave this camp without an insignia and without some of your rank on it. Mm-hmm. So they had a whole bunch of seamstresses set up, gals set up down there, sewing insignias on.
Yeah.
Like you see my sunset, that's a division insignia, it's a sun division, sunset division. Yeah. So we had those they put on and they put stripes on. And we went on and got on train, went to New York City and stayed for about 12, 14 hours and came back to camp. And then I went to Camp Grand, Illinois, and then over to Fort Sheridan. And that's where we discharged. 2 days later, matter of fact, I came home on the 6th of January. I discharged on the 8th. I want to tell you a little story about a train ride in Japan. We're going to take a ride on a train. They encourage people to ride it, get away as much as you can and see some of the countryside, you know. So we get on this train, and this conductor came through, Japanese. I would say a man 45 years old or so, you know. And, hi, guys, you know, like this, you know. Spoke English as well as we did, and he was carrying a basket with it, and we only went a short distance. Train pulled off on the siding, and he said, the Emperor's train is coming by, and I can't watch it. You can, but I can't. And so we got out and watched it, and it went like this with all the blinds pulled, you know, and it had the Emperor's seal on the side, you know. And so he said, now we have to stay at least 1 hour. We cannot leave it. We cannot follow that train for at least 1 hour. So there was a park there, kind of like one of our, like Hickey, you know, one of our parks around here, you know, had shrines in it. And picnic benches. He said, I have some sandwiches. You guys like to go over and have some sandwich with me. So we did. We got into sat down. The very first thing he said, any of you live in Chicago? And a couple of us had. And he said, I live in Chicago all my life. And so, of course, our next question, why are you here? He came home and they wouldn't let him go back. They wouldn't let him leave. He wouldn't give him his papers to go back home. But he said, the minute they said go, I'm going, I have a whole lot of family in Chicago. You know, I never saw any animosity from a Japanese. Personally, I never saw it. You know, people say, oh, somebody spit on them in France. I mean, you know, whatever this kind of story, but it never happened. They were doing their job and working where they had to, and they were doing what they were told, and they were workers and people and inhabiting the country and doing what they were told to do. The military was the ones that were the problem, not the Japanese citizens, you know.
I know we're running short on time here, but I got to get the story of how you ended up with your medals finally. So you went 60 years without caring whether you had your medals or not?
My family kept saying, you know, you need to get those medals. We need them. You, when we're gone, somebody needs those medals, you know. So I contacted St. Louis, where they keep all of them, you know. They had to contact for the records and make sure, and they sent back a letter saying these are what you're entitled to, you know. And you'll get them with 30 days. 6 months went by, or longer, huh? More, probably more than 6 months. Nothing. Contact again. Oh, yeah, you'll get them one of these days. I guess probably a year went by. And finally I contacted Kelly at Jim Costa's office. She said, well, show what we can do. Another 6 months went by. And finally they got a letter saying, oh, they're sitting on somebody's desk. We'll get them out, sent out to you. And finally then after that, it was probably 30 days after that, that Jim got them, and so did I get them then. So, and that was 05 I got my medals, yeah. Yeah, 05. So that's been 7 years. Yeah.
Yeah, the congressman came down and presented them to you. And what did that mean to you, to see that bronze star and the rest of these medals all those years later?
Pride. Biggest thing, pride, you know. And that, well, that you maybe had done that much. You know. And then about 2 weeks later, Jim brought me a flag that had flown over the United States Capitol.
Well, if I may, let me take you back to a place about as far away from the Capitol as you can get. That little island that you guys needed to capture for the airstrip, that bullet that enters the front of your helmet, rattles around the lining, and goes out. Did you ever give that helmet back to the lieutenant who lent it to you?
He took it home, as far as I know. Matter of fact, my history book has a picture of him holding it.
I'm going to put that picture on our website at kmjnow.com so you can look at it. And when you look at that picture, you see where that hole is. When you think about how different things could have been, you wouldn't have come home. You never would have met Alice. Your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids would have never been born.
He also was shot through his helmet. His lieutenant was. Same day. The same within a few yards. The same thing. And his grazed his shoulder enough that he had retreated for it. Didn't hurt mine, it wasn't that, but he had retreated for it, John. Because people were being shot all over the place, and I don't know how many others were shot through that. I have no idea, because we're shot below the helmets and all the other places, you know, but I have no idea. But
so his helmet saved you, and your helmet saved him.
That's right. We put the wrong ones on. middle of the night, we put the wrong ones on.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when you think about that, and that's not the only close call you had, and here you are in Hiroshima around all of that, everything that you went through, 500 nights sleeping in foxholes, when you think about all that, but you're still here, and there's all these people in your family that wouldn't have been here if you didn't survive that, do you have an idea of why, of how that happened, how it worked out the way it did?
Somebody sitting on your shoulder, wasn't there? That's right. It's all taken care of, isn't it? It's all planned, isn't it? Not by me, not by the Army. That's right. I feel 100%. I've been angels. We're both great believers in angels. Great believers in angels. We both are. You know, many times in our lives, you know, we've seen effects of it. We're both great believers of it. I couldn't think otherwise.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone can argue with you after hearing your story. Thank you for serving our country. I know that we probably only scratched the surface of everything that you experienced and everything you still deal with, and we appreciate what you've done for us.
Thank you very much.
That's Les Collins. Quite the story. You can see a photo of Les and his wife of nearly 63 years now, Alice, at kmjnow.com, where you can also listen to this entire interview. We're out of time today, but I hope you'll join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
Interesting sidelight, just the 162nd Infantry Regiment was commanded by Colonel Archie Roosevelt. He was a son of Teddy Roosevelt, and we saw him a lot of times. I used to see him quite a lot in New Guinea and the Philippines, you know, but he was not young, of course. He was a colonel in the Army, and he was probably in his 50s, I would say he was, at least, you know. But, Teddy Roosevelt had a son who was a brigadier general in World War II, you know, and he had another son killed in World War I. You know.
Well, let me ask you, because now, I mean, you've lived this, and that's been your story for 70 years. But before that, before you entered the military, I imagine you had some ambitions. You had some ideas of what you thought you were going to do with your life.
My parents were divorced when I was 2 years old, and I didn't live with either of them. I lived with some strangers for a couple of years, two or three different families. This was in Danville, Illinois. And when I was 4 years old, my brother was 4 years older than I, they decided, there was a judge there that knew our family and said, these boys need somebody to take care of them. So we called all the family, my aunt and uncle, my dad's sister and her husband were the only ones that came. They lived on a farm and outside of Danville, about 15 miles. And they came and they wanted to adopt us. My parents would not allow it, but they gave us guardianship. So from the time I was 4 until I was 13 and my brother was 17, we lived with them on a farm. And then I went to a country one-room school. The last years there were four of us in the whole school. And so I graduated by seventh grade instead of the eighth. And then my uncle passed away, and my dad had bought a house in town. And my grandparents had retired from the farm and moved that house. My aunt moved there with them, and another aunt of hers moved there. So there's no place for a 13 and 17-year-old boy. So we moved to Detroit to live by ourselves, the two of us. I was 13 and he was 17.
And the two of you were living by yourselves in Detroit.
Would you imagine that today? Wouldn't you like to have, you have like a 13-year-old boy going? But they didn't bother us, you know. Life was a lot different in those days, you know. I guess I could have sat on the curb and cried and somebody come along and say, young man, what can I do for you? It wasn't, don't come slug me or rob me or something else. And I went from that small country school of four pupils, Highland Park High School, had 7,000 students. It was the second largest high school in the United States. You know, Highland Park itself is a city completely surrounded by the city of Detroit. Detroit on one side, we had Hamtramck on the other side. And so there was no place for it to grow. So it was about 100,000, 80,000 population probably in those days. And the Ford plant was down the street about two blocks from where I was. And my brother went for worked for a theater as assistant manager. And school was so big that we went to school from 7 in the morning till noon or noon till 5. And then I had two newspaper stands. And I had a young fellow that had one worked with me in front of a White Tower hamburger stand. My brother had the other stand down by the theater. And so, as you know, in a large city, you have all these editions of newspaper, you know, early morning, late finals, five-star final, sports final. And people knew I was going to be there till 11 o'clock at night, so they'd come by and buy papers, you know. And there were a lot of offices and things around that part of town. So I would stay there till 11 o'clock at night, close up, my brother come, we'd go home and go back to school at 7 o'clock the next morning. Well, on Wednesday nights, there was an old Liberty magazine, which was, it was the nickel, so they called it Liberty magazine in those days. I had about 100 customers delivered that for. I made a penny a piece selling magazines. And a paper was about a penny. I used to make a lot of money, $15, $16 a week. And there were grown men with families made $30 a month. There were a lot of men with supporting families on a dollar a day in those days, you know. So, yeah. But it went well and stayed there. And then decided to, that was in Detroit, and I went to work for Chicago for, I had gone to Chicago for Walgreens Drug Store first, and I was only 15 and a half years old. My first job was working for Walgreens, I told you the other day, on 71st and Jeffrey in South Chicago. I had a sister and brother that lived at 69 and Danny in South Chicago, which is a few blocks away, and never lived with them, but I lived myself in an apartment. But anyway, I worked for Walgreens, and then I decided to go back to Detroit, which I did, and then worked for a men's furnishing and clothing store. And that's where I was when I went into service, was working for a men's clothing and furniture store in a clothing and shoe store. We had those big old shoe stores. You've probably never seen one. You're too young. But we had their shoes in the wall and a ladder that went all the way around and boxes up in the wall. And you go around the ladder, great big heavy cases that with all our things on it, you know. But, and that's when I went into service. And Harry Stiglitz, a man that owned the store, and he was really great. And he said, you ever come back when you get out from the war? Well, you have a job with me. But, of course, I was gone for well over 3 years. I was overseas 1943, 44, and 1945. And so I came home. And, of course, he'd long since retired to Florida. But, you know, the ironic part of that, Paul, was I was walking, going across. I moved to Miami because I couldn't stand to climb anymore in the Midwest, you know. And my brother was living in Miami in those days. And he had a little youngster in those days. So I went down to Miami to live, close the climate, and was riding a bus across the Miami Beach one day, and here sat Harry Stiglitz on the bus. And I had worked for him back in 1940, in the late 30s, you know. And he said, oh, I wish I had the energy to open a store down here, let you manage it for me. But he said, he was 71 or something, 2 years old or something at the time. He said, no way, and his son didn't want the business. So he just retired to Miami and Miami Beach, you know. But and then I went to work for the post office. Everybody was taking post office federal exams in those days, you know, and they gave extra points for veterans. So another fellow I took it, I had like overseas time and combat medics and infantry, and I had extra points, you know. So we both took it and passed the exam and started to work at the post office as many hours as we wanted. Miami Post Office had 700 employees. They were just starting to be able to ship overseas in those days, you know, because of the relaxation of rules and everything, of packages and everything. And so we worked as many hours as we wanted and made a whole $1.28 an hour, if I remember, in those days. Starting pay for post office regular pay was like $2,800 a year in those days. And then later, I worked there about a year, a little later, and the post office exam things came through, and we were the top two in the exams. And I said, what does entail getting a full-time job? And he said, working 12 hours at night in the back room, sorting mail. And I said, I was still sick. I still had malaria off and on all the time. You know, and I said, no way. So another fellow and I opened a service station way out in Northwest 79th Street in Miami. And he was an expert mechanic, and we had that station for about a year and a half. And that's when I decided to go and visit my mother in Edgewood, New Mexico, where she had a restaurant, and that's where I met Alice.
Getting back to when you went in the service, though, it sounds like that didn't interrupt some big ambition or anything. You think you probably would have kept working where you were working if Uncle Sam didn't call?
No, I had ambition to be a pharmacist or a doctor because I had worked in Walgreens drugstore for a year and a half or 2 years, you know, and I thought. And so that's what, of course, eventually led me to becoming a medic in the service because I went in the infantry and we were in Australia. They came around and said, who would like to volunteer to be medics? So half a dozen of us did, you know, so I did. That's what's happened. So I spent the next year and a half, almost 2 years in the combat medics. And
what do you remember about when you first went overseas? Because here you are a pretty young man, what, 20 years old when you shipped out?
Of course, the Australian people are fantastic. No Australian troops there. I mean, they were all gone to England, you know. We were stationed first in Melbourne, Australia, in Sydney, Australia, at a racetrack, Ascot Park, and we had a whole division set up, and Ascot Park was a racetrack. And then we moved a whole division to Rockhampton, Australia, which is about 400 miles north of Brisbane. And Japanese troops were down at Port Moresby, New Guinea, which is a very tip, you know, right opposite Townsville, Australia. And so MacArthur sent, we had two army divisions, ours and the 32nd Division from the Midwest. And we formed a line of demarcation across about 200 or 300 miles south of Townsville in case the Japanese came across, you know. And we were there for 3 or 4 weeks, and then they sent us back to our camp in Rockhampton. And then we went to New Guinea from there for 6 months and back to Australia for replacements, back to New Guinea again, and then on up the coast and all the way up to through New Guinea and Oliver Beach Islands and all that stuff through New Guinea and the Philippines, you know. We used to go in this small town of Rockhampton, and they had, of course, it was before TVs, but they had reading rooms and places. They had kind of a USO type. It was Australian, but take care of the troops, you know. We were in there one day, this very good buddy of mine that I'd been with all the time, and he said, that gal said, there is a bulletin board over there, and it has names of Australian families who'd love to have American troops come to visit them, you know, and have dinner or something, you know. So we went over, looked at this, and we asked him, look at the one, he said, oh, they're fantastic people. He's a chief clerk for the railroad for the province of Queensland. And so we went and said, go out there, it's only 3 or 4 blocks, you can walk over there, which we did, and went over there, and we stood in front of the house and watched. We said, no, we're not going to do that. Suddenly a little head popped out through a window, you know. We said, well, we'd better go in that case, you know. So we went over, and they adopted us. We just stayed there, and she did her laundry, and every Sunday we'd go to the coast and ride the train with them, and they had this old, what I call the tuna reel trolley, this real narrow-gauge train, you know, and it was 13 miles to Yeppoon, Australia, on the coast. And so we get on the train the very first time, and with his family, they had two little kids, about a little girl and a little boy, about 7 and 9. And so we get on the train, she takes a picnic lunch, and we head to the coast, and about halfway there, we stopped the train going. I could walk fast, and this train went. But anyway, we ended up and stopped in a beautiful place, and a big home down there, a big place, building down there. And it was a cricket court. So we stopped, sat on the hillside, watched them play cricket, and went and on the coast and ate our lunch. And every Sunday, that's what we used to do, is go and stay with that family. See, we were there over 5 months. So we used to go. We had Class A passes into town anytime we were able to get off, where we could go into town anytime, you know, and so. But our division was stretched along 13 straight miles. There were 20,000 troops stretched along 13 miles between there and the coast, you know, and so. And the only buildings were mess halls.